Good morning. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And you know, Real Life is the radio show that's dedicated to women who are ready to love life and make joy a part of the daily dialogue. I don't know about you, but I have had a very busy week, and I have been, it's been a week filled with work and got to spend some really great time with my son this week and visiting with friends and singing and playing music, and I've cried a little and laughed a lot. And now we have paused to share these next 60 minutes together. So I invite you to join me in a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. This morning I'm just having some black Lipton's tea. Find a quiet place and let the next 60 minutes be a way to show yourself some kindness this morning. My guest could be described by any number of words, but defined by none. Seeker of truth, scientist, traveler, businessman, father, teacher, spiritualist, Charles Eisenstein is the author of The Ascent of Humanity, a book described by one reviewer as putting his finger on the core problem facing humanity, and who in his web bio describes the last 5 years of his life as a birthing process. Good morning, Charles, and welcome to Real Life.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah.
So we often talk about, on this show, we talk about stories and the stories we tell ourselves and about the world, and as a result, the world and our lives really show up that way. And I'd like to explore some of your stories with you, and maybe starting with the story about you and your path over the last, I don't know how many years, 20 years, but you've certainly had an interesting journey.
Yeah. I think I keep getting letters from people who say that their journey parallels my own, especially from people in my generation, but some older ones too. And, you know, I had the experience of not being able to wholeheartedly play the game and live the life that was offered to me. And so in my 20s, I didn't know what the alternative was, you know. So in my 20s, I kind of played along, but half-heartedly, and sabotaged myself a lot, was kind of, you know, procrastinated a lot, just did the bare minimum. Some people in my generation took it a bit farther, got addicted, got depressed. And so in various ways, we all found a way to just get by and not participate in a world that we believed on some level we knew that it was on the wrong track. And for me, this realization came to a head in my mid to late 20s when I was in some kind of meeting. I was living in Taiwan and doing translation and helping businesses localize their products into English. And we had this meeting where I looked around the room and I thought to myself, hold on, you mean you guys really care about this? Because I'm only pretending to care about it because you're paying me to. But I don't really care about it. So I felt, for a few moments, I felt this kind of gloating superiority. But the next feeling after that was panic, because I thought, well, do I get to do anything that I really care about for real this lifetime and not just that I'm paid to care about? Like, do I get to live my life instead of being a servant to something I don't even believe in? And once I had that realization, I became almost unable to do my work. And that launched this journey where it just became the most important thing to me to find what it is that I was here for. Why am I here on earth? Why am I alive? And that's the journey that ended up in writing The Ascent of Humanity and all the stuff I do today.
So you have three sons,
mm-hmm.
and you're a single dad, is that right?
Yeah.
But and I understand you share parenting with your ex-wife.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they're here during the week and with her on the weekends. But occasionally we play it by ear and cover for each other.
So, Charles, you and I met this weekend, this past weekend, when you were giving a talk in... Oh, I didn't say that. Charles is joining us from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So he was giving us a giving a talk up in that area that I went up for. And what I understood in what I was hearing you say as we before you were giving your talk was that you and your ex-wife really work together in a way that, you know, to parent as opposed to having these really clearly defined maybe legal lines. And it sounds like you're really supportive of each other.
Yeah, I don't think we thought of it that way originally, but looking back, I see us as kind of pioneering a new way of relationship transition. I mean, there were certainly some rough patches, but you know, so many of the old institutions are breaking down. Including, you know, when I talk about the old normal or the world offered me and feeling it to be wrong, it's not just the institutions of work. I mean, it's also the way that families and marriages are set up now. It's very much of an old world. And so many people are transitioning out of that and into something new, which we don't even know what it is yet necessarily. And different people are exploring it in different ways. But certainly, whatever it is, it doesn't include years of legal battles and enmity. We understand that there's a more beautiful way to do it, and that's kind of what Patsy and I were doing. And I can't say we're 100% successful, but I would say that we're almost best friends right now.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I am joined by Charles Eisenstein, and he has written a number of books. The one that I'm most familiar with at this point is The Ascent of Humanity. And we're talking about the way we can recreate the story of life, really, I think. And so, Charles, one of the reasons I wanted to kind of explore a little bit your relationship with your wife is because of my understanding, again, of what, and I don't know how much of it is projection or, you know, how much of it is what you're actually saying, but there's a new and different way to be in community that we can actually really rely on each other, and we need to. And so, but before we get into this new way, I'd like you to paint the picture of the old story as you see it.
Okay. I think I should maybe even talk about what I mean by story.
Okay.
It's not necessarily a distinct narrative, but it includes that. But it basically it means a system of beliefs and interpretations and meanings. It's what we use to answer the question, how does the world work? Why am I here? What's my role in society? How do you be human? What is a human? What is a self? It gives meaning to life. Without stories, all we have are a bunch of facts. So, for example, to take the example of relationship transition, you know, there are certain facts. She did this, then I did that, then, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a story you can build around those facts. And the story title could be, "Isn't She Awful?" And then you can interpret all of those facts to support that story, to fit into that story. And then you can call all your friends and have them back it up. Yeah, she sure is awful. You know what she told me? You know, no, right? And so you can create a story. And a story then assigns roles to people and guides the way that we act and the way that we think. So once we've accepted a certain story, then we're going to act it out. Now, so taking that outside of just a personal relationship, in society, we could have a story, say, of America champions of freedom. And according to that story, and so someone who believes that story will interpret news and various inputs in a certain way, and then will act in a certain way as well. Whereas someone who believes the story of, you know, America, imperialist predator, will think, act, and feel in a different way. And so stories are what, on a collective level, stories are what we use to create reality. Anything that depends on agreements is a story. For example, America is a story. A corporation is a story. Money is a story. Property is a story. And these stories have power to the extent that we agree on them and share their meanings. So the stories I just named are somewhat conscious stories, but underneath these are these deep unconscious stories that color the way that we see the world and upon which our whole civilization is built. So one of the stories is the story of separation that says, what is it to be? You know, what are you? You are a bubble of psychology inside a prison of flesh. You are a separate being looking out onto a universe, and the universe outside of your body, that's not you. That's something else. That's other. Or maybe you're a soul encased in flesh. That's what you are. Or you're a biological organism driven by your genes to maximize reproductive self-interest. Or you're an economic actor seeking to maximize financial self-interest, or whatever. It's all these separate beings out there competing with each other and in an objective universe that's not self. So more for you is less for me. What happens to you doesn't really affect what happens to me. As long as I can protect myself from other beings, then I'm fine. So goodness, wealth, etc., comes from winning and protecting and insulating. And conquering. So this comes into science or medicine, you know, that health comes through conquering disease, conquering germs, controlling body processes, more control, more domination. It comes into, and you can just think, you know, in our relationship to nature, our relationship to other societies, et cetera, et cetera. So in invisible or semi-visible ways, this story has created a whole civilization. And the other story that defines our civilization is the story of ascent, which says that humanity was once helpless, ignorant. Then we developed science and technology and came to dominate and master nature, and someday we will transcend nature altogether, colonize the stars, make synthetic food, conquer death, conquer disease, etc. And so both of these stories have defined our civilization for a long time, and they're both coming to an end. They're dying. We no longer really believe in them anymore. And that's why people in my generation especially, but even earlier to some extent, didn't fully participate anymore. Maybe I'll leave it there and see what you want to say about that, but then I can also relate that to the dissolution of community, because that's one of the aspects of separation.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, I'm joined by Charles Eisenstein, and hearing about stories and the stories we tell and the stories we live by. Charles, I am very interested to pursue the dissolution of community.
Okay. Well, so we have this story or this belief system, this paradigm that says we're these separate beings in an objective universe that is impersonal, indifferent to us, and we've created all kinds of technology, all kinds of money systems, all kinds of cultural systems that embody this story. So one of the precepts of it is basically, I don't need you. This comes through especially in money. If In a traditional tribe or a village, say, I mean, even like a small town 150 years ago, 200 years ago, if the local doctor or the local blacksmith or the local barrel maker really didn't like you, you couldn't just pay somebody else to do it because there wasn't anybody else nearby. So maybe money was used to some extent, but there was personal relationships mattered too. Today it's no longer true that I depend on any specific person. As long as I have enough money, I can buy anything I need. So if the farmer that has grown the food I ate this morning dies, that's okay. I can pay somebody else for my food. Same with clothing, same with entertainment, same with everything that I use. So I don't need anybody. Now, people hunger for community, and we miss these connections. And they want to get it back, and so they'll try to get it back. They'll convene groups and have potlucks and stuff. But underneath those gatherings is the knowledge, I don't need you. It's not like it, you know, in an Amish farming community or a tribe where people depended on each other. And in which there were huge consequences for violating community trust or not being a productive member of the community, not abiding by community norms. You know, it was terrible. I mean, you could be ostracized. You know, it was almost a death. It was even worse than a death sentence. But today it doesn't really matter. So on my block here, almost nobody knows anybody else. Everyone's living these separate lives. And it's essentially because life has been converted into money. We pay for everything. There's no gift culture anymore. We don't do things for each other for free. Everything's a service instead. And it hurts. It makes us lonely because, you know, the story of separation, that what you are is a separate self, that's not true, as a matter of fact. And it's becoming less and less true. And it's never been true, but it's becoming more apparently untrue. And the truth is that we are our connections. We, the connections to other people, the connections to nature. We're meant to be embedded in a rich matrix of intimate connection, such as ancient people were, where they, every face was intimately known to them. Every hill, every plant, every bird, they knew. It was a, you know, you knew what the bird, any bird you looked at, you knew what its song was. You know, you knew what plants it ate. You knew what insects it ate. You knew when it migrated and what its mating habits were and what plants were used for what medicine and the story of every hill and every river and every pond. And that, and the stories of other people, everybody knew the time that you fell through the ice when you were 8 years old and every story. And so we were so well known that we knew ourselves as well. We had a robust identity, and we felt connected, and we felt not so insecure. The separate self is insecure, but the connected self is secure because we are this vast web of connections. We're not a lonely, isolated ego, and we miss that terribly. We want to recreate it.
You know, I think it was on Friday night when you were giving the talk, you had said something about the young people today are angry, and maybe this has been for some number of generations, because they can't buy into the story, this story of the separate self.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
I think
you
it's
know,
fascinating.
One or two generations ago, you could buy into it a lot more easily because things seem to be working okay. You know, at least if you were in America, you know, in a wealthy country, it looked like the ascent of humanity, the conquest of nature was going to work okay. And it looked like the American dream, you know, that this paradise of financial independence, that was looking pretty good too. It looked like we were maybe going to conquer all disease, you know, that maybe we were going to have space colonies. If it was in 1960 or 1968, you know, we were going to apply science to politics. They even called it political science. We're going to apply science to engineering the perfect society. And we're going to eliminate poverty. We're going to eliminate cancer. We're going to eliminate drugs. We're going to create a perfect world through the application of science and technology, and we're going to enter this gleaming utopian future. Like, you could still believe in that in the 50s and 60s. It wasn't so far-fetched. But today, it's really hard to believe in that. It's really hard to believe that we're on the verge of conquering all disease when so many new diseases have appeared out of nowhere that defy the technologies of control, that doctors are helpless to do anything but palliate symptoms temporarily. We don't believe in it anymore. We don't believe. I mean, when was the last advance in space travel? You know, it was decades ago. We don't believe in this program anymore. And so the young people are not motivated as they were in like the 50s, you know, to be a NASA scientist, you know, or a nuclear engineer. Like, that's where the idealistic passion was back then, but not anymore. Now it's toward things that are not encouraged and rewarded in that old world, things like, you know, permaculture. You know, someone might be passionate about that. Well, where's the big money in permaculture that was once in being a nuclear engineer? So we're in a transition here where the incentives and rewards and structures of the old world no longer can accommodate us.
And Charles, just a couple of months ago, I wrote a blog entry about exactly what you're pointing to about this idea of separation, and that I have created my life, and I get that I'm a product of, to some degree, or maybe in full degree, of the culture in which I live, but I have become self-sufficient. You know, and I was even thinking about, okay, so now I have a laptop. I can, wherever I go, I don't have to ask if there's a computer I can borrow. And now I've bought an air card, so I don't even have to depend upon somebody else's wireless internet system. You know, I can find my own. And those are just little tiny examples. I've totally surrounded myself so that I really truly don't need people. And I am now waking up to the realization that I am hungry for a greater connection with my community, and not in just those kind of dart throwing ways of having a potluck or taking a meal to somebody who's sick. I really am looking forward to this idea of weaving a web of community. And we have to take a short break right now, Charles, but when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about the news story and about the connected self. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining me this morning, I'm talking with Charles Eisenstein and just this fascinating conversation about stories of separation and of connections. So, Charles, we were kind of, when we went into the break, we were talking about the dissolution and disconnection of community, and now I'd like to kind of bring us back on the upswing and talk about where do we go from here. You know, one of my questions is how do we begin to allow ourselves to need each other, you know, within community?
Well, one way that it happens is that the economy collapses and people can no longer pay for all the things that they need, and that's why poor people have much more community than wealthy people in general. If you go to the ghetto, you know, people are helping each other out all the time, and even more so in third world countries. There's still a gift economy there because people just don't have the money, and they have needs, and they have things to offer each other, but they just don't have the money to make those exchanges happen, so they do it in a gift economy instead. Community is woven from gifts and stories. Those are the warp and woof of community. So just as the money economy has replaced the gift economy and destroyed community, by the same token, to reestablish community, you have to have gifts to offer and to receive, which means that you can't have community just as an add-on to a completely monetarily self-sufficient life where you pay for everything and you want to have just some nice people and have community on top of that. That doesn't work. You have to actually invest something of yourself and be willing to give and to receive things that people actually need and things that you actually need. So those could be, you know, quantifiable material things if you don't have the money to acquire them. If you do have the money, then giving those things doesn't really mean very much. But fortunately, there are a lot of things that we desperately need that money cannot buy. And those are the things that we can begin to weave community from among people who understand that they need those things. For example, when I you know, I've become really dissatisfied with recorded music of any kind, even if it's like my favorite band, because it's not being sung to me. It's being sung at a studio somewhere or recorded live at a concert, but I have a desperate, deep hunger for songs or music played for me, like by someone who knows me, who's in my energy field, who sees me, and is giving it to me. That it meets a need in me that money fundamentally cannot meet. Even if I hired a band to come to my house, they could just be doing a performance, you know, and not really playing for me. So that's something that could create community. Or food that's actually cooked for me. Most people today get most of their food prepared by other people at a restaurant or a supermarket deli, or even like food that's, you know, pre-cooked basically, and you just heat it up in the microwave. Like for a lot of people, that's every meal. And it satisfies all of the quantifiable needs for calories and nutrition, but there's an unquantifiable need that it cannot satisfy. So one way to create community is, there's two ways. One is to meet quantifiable needs because people are too poor, don't have the money to meet them with money. And the second way is to meet the unquantifiable needs that money fundamentally cannot meet. And so if you want to create community, and that's only half of it. The other half is stories. You can't just have a bunch of strangers exchanging that on some electronic gift exchange, you know. I mean, that's really what money does after all, right? Money mediates gifts and needs too. So you also have to have stories that tell you who this person is and that tell them who you are. And so, and we have such, human beings have such a natural urge to do this. When we get together, the first thing we do is we tell stories about the people we know in common. This is a good thing. It's not, this isn't gossip. This is a way that we knit ourselves together into a larger whole. So that's where I see, I mean, it's a bit vague, but that's kind of the conceptual basis of the ways that, you know, I'm exploring to create community.
When you were talking about wanting to identify who this person is, what immediately came to mind for me was, or is Facebook. And how people are revealing so much about their personal lives and their thoughts and their feelings and breaking up with somebody on Facebook. And
yes,
it feels like this very distanced way to tell stories.
Yeah, I think, like, I wouldn't say Facebook is bad. I would say that it's a substitute or a response to what's something that's missing. So if you have, if, you know, community is destroyed, you don't have gathering places, but we still have this need to involve ourselves in each other's stories, then Facebook comes along and provides a way to do that. A lot of technology in general does the same thing. It doesn't meet a new need, but it meets an existing need that has been, that we've been cut off from. For example, like, say, the automobile. Do human beings have an innate need to travel hundreds of miles? No. Only if you need to go places that are distant. Why do we need to go such distant places? Well, it's because we don't, we're not economically tied to local places anymore, and we don't know the people around us. Our friends live far away. So now we have to drive. And how did that situation arise? It arose in part because of the automobile, because of the landscape of the exit ramp, you know, in suburbia. So what's happened is that technology has taken things away and then kind of sells it back to us. So we don't have gathering places anymore. Instead, we pay for Facebook. Well, through advertising, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Charles, will you lead us in a practice this morning?
Sure. I was going to do something around the gift. I should context it a little bit.
Okay.
I've been talking about how community is woven from gifts, and there's something more fundamental, though, about the gift and what's happening today on Earth, that we are entering new stories that are replacing the story of separation and the story of ascent and domination. And the new stories, I mentioned it, it's the connected self and co-creative partnership with Earth, an Earth that we have fallen in love with and desire to give back to and not just take from. And humanity collectively is being born into a vastly more beautiful world. And it hasn't quite been born yet. We see it on the horizon. We see a light coming from the future that we're making our way toward. But there's a lot of work between here and there. I believe that every person alive today has a unique and necessary contribution to make toward the birthing of this new state of human beingness. Just like in an ecosystem, every species has a necessary role, and if it's eliminated, the entire ecosystem becomes weaker. They're not in this competition with each other. Like in the separation, you'd think that you eliminate one species and you're going to be better off because you've gotten rid of one of your competitors. But no, actually, nature is a gift network. It's a web of gifts, each being giving to the whole. And humans are like that too. So each person has a gift or many gifts to offer. And in fact, that's why we're here. I talked about that feeling. I want to live my own life. You know, I want to live why, for the purpose that I've been put here. That purpose has to do with my gifts. So if we want to make that into a little practice, I guess, yeah, so those of you who are listening, you can just close your eyes and enter into the default state of gratitude that's within all human beings. This life has been given to you. You didn't work hard to earn being alive, to earn oxygen to breathe and food to eat, the existence of food and this beautiful earth. All has been given to us. And having received such a big gift, we feel gratitude and the desire to give in turn. And you can feel this gratitude and urge to generosity in your heart. And so just let that feeling emerge. Feeling, I'm here to give something important. And it feels good to give that. It feels good to give a gift towards something you believe in, something beautiful. And then there's another voice inside of you that says, I can't afford to give. I can't afford to live by the gift because what if this, what if that? Financial pressure, time pressure. But the universe is generous. And if we desire to step into the gift, just one more step, to give birth to the community by giving, and to feel the joy of enacting our purpose and we're a little afraid, then the generosity of the universe says, okay, I will give you an opportunity just at the edge of your courage and not beyond it to step a little more into living from the gift. And so as your day and your weekend stretch in front of you, and imagine it stretching in front of you, and there's a choice point up ahead. And it's going to happen, and you're going to identify it. When it happens, you're going to remember. And you're going to say, and it's going to feel like, which do I choose here? Generosity or fear? Self-protection or opening? And at that moment, imagine tapping into this feeling of gratitude and choosing the generosity. And visualize yourself doing that. And bring into yourself now the feeling of openness and expansiveness. And trust that you will have. Okay.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Real Life with Jennifer Till, brought to you by Virginia National Bank. And if you're just joining us this morning, Charles Eisenstein just led us in this beautiful practice around identifying our gifts and stepping into generosity and openness. And Charles, I know sometimes, maybe often, that can feel like a scary choice, or I can forget that that's the way I want to be moving. How can we create support structures in our lives to help us remember?
I think that right now many people are identifying others around them who want to live in the same way. And so we can remind each other that what we're doing is not crazy. And because in the old world and the world that, you know, still exists today as kind of an inertia, it's crazy to do anything that voice says I can't afford to give anything. I mean, you could, whether you're giving money or time or something else, you could spend that time, you know, making more money or, you know, doing something that's going to benefit you, self-aggrandizement of some sort. Or, you know, it's crazy to, if you're in college, to major in something just because you love it. And it's not practical. And so there's all these voices in the past. There were all these voices saying, oh, you can't major in art, you know. Maybe graphic design, right? There's always this practical thing to do that the voices around us encouraged, and that we had to fight against, we had to struggle against it, and it's hard to do it alone. And we all went through this time of loneliness, but that time is coming to an end. And now there are enough people who are living aspects of the new story of connection that says, "What I do to the world will affect me. What I give to the world will come back to me. I don't know how, but I know that it will." We can now, enough people now are believing this, maybe not in those words, but they're living in that way, that we can now surround ourselves or network with enough of these people that can give voice to the urging of our heart and not to the fear of the egoic mind that tells us to stay small, stay safe, be practical, don't give too much, and be wary and calculating of what you can afford. We have enough allies now. And so on a personal level, you know, you can do that for the people around you and speak, make yourself an ally of their heart so that they can do what they want to do and receive the benefits therefrom.
I love that, ally of their heart. That's so such a beautiful image.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just look at yourself that way. And you know, again, you'll have opportunities to do that. That will come up, and you can practice that and discover new ways to do that. And I keep discovering new ways in which I'm not doing that, too. I'm like, oh, I've been, you know, just in very subtle ways. For example, when I'm judgmental towards somebody, that's part of the old story of separation that says that, you know, there's this bad thing in you that you have to overcome and fight and dominate. It's part of the control of nature, the domination of nature. And I guess I don't have time to go into all that, but let's just say that it's a journey.
Yeah, and I would love to, I'll just take this opportunity to invite you back. And Charles, you and I had talked about you coming down to Charlottesville to give a talk or a workshop in the near future, maybe towards the end of April or May. And
yeah, I'm just kind of waiting for that to coalesce. but it seems like there's a draw.
Yeah, the energies are gathering.
Yeah.
And so I will certainly let our listeners know when that is, and I'd like to invite you back maybe for some part of the show when you are in town.
Okay.
I think that might be fun. I also, you've touched upon so many rich areas today, and I feel as though you've left me with quite a bit to kind of to digest and work through. And just to go back to the idea of being the ally of their heart, I like the image of being the ally of my heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Because when we're struggling with that idea of separation and I'm putting that person out there or over there, I think that starts within my own heart and looking here and, as you said, identifying those places where I separate myself.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't be hard on yourself, though. You know, when you do discover a way that you're fighting against your heart, then you can say, well, maybe I'm almost done doing that.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole, like, the habits of separation run so deep, you know. We tend to turn everything into a battle against evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, no, now it was a battle against sin, and then it became a battle against ego, and then the latest bogeyman is fear, mm-hmm. you know, and love has to win over fear, and you have to conquer fear. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just more conquest,
yeah.
more domination. And to stop doing that is not an act of struggle. At least for me, it hasn't been an act of struggle. It's
right.
been an act of ease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Esotericism. That's my my belief system.
Yeah.
So Charles, that is about all the time we have this morning, and I really want to thank you for joining us, and I'm looking forward to the next time you and I get to have an adventure together, and hopefully that will be when you come down to Charlottesville.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to thank you for spending part of your weekend with us this morning. And remember to log on to jennifertill.com where you can get podcasts of the show. I understand that we had some technical difficulties last weekend, and I got a number of emails from people asking why couldn't they hear the show. And it did start late, but if you want to hear the entire show, you can catch it on jennifertill.com. And the show last week was Engaged Buddhism. Until next Saturday at 8 o'clock, remember to ask yourself, what's the kindest thing I can do for me right now? See you next week.